Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. And a brief tribute this week to Martin Cosgrave, who died in Malaga in Spain. He was a sound engineer from Easton who was part of the original Dialect crew back in 2001. So, rest in peace, Martin. And appropriately this week, a hard-hitting interview from The Libyan War, The Truth. And that's the name of a website, in fact, libyanwarthetruth.com. A couple, Joanne and James Moriarty, who were there, who witnessed it. The getting rid of, in fact, the execution by mob of Colonel Gaddafi, who took over power in Libya in 1967 in a bloodless coup and uprooted King Idris, who was the British and the colonialists' choice to run Libya. Gaddafi successfully turned Libya into one of the best countries in Africa. In fact, the highest living standards, the lowest child mortality rate, and no debt with the International Monetary Fund. So that's this week, the Libyan War, The Truth special. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you've got somebody you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready, please, at the end of the show.
My name is Joanne Moriarty. I'm a U.S. citizen living in Texas. My husband and I, James, were in Libya since 2007 doing business in the oil and gas industry. In 2011, we had a lot of contracts, wanted to keep our business there. We didn't see any of the problems that they were talking about when they fomented the 2011 NATO destruction.
Can you just give us an idea of what you were doing in the oil and gas industry? What were you actually up to?
I'm James Moriarty,
my husband,
Texan, living in deep southeast Texas. And Joanne and I own a proprietary technology that rejuvenates oil wells, cleans up pipelines and sludge pits. We do a medical-grade DNA manipulation of microbes. We produce literally millions of kinds of enzymes. And in Libya, we had booked more than $5 billion worth of business. And we had moved our entire production and marketing facilities into Libya. Those were on the water in the first week of January 2011. Before they ever got to Libya, the phony civil war started. All our materials and equipment landed in Misrata sometime in March and April of 2011. It all disappeared. That was $200 million of money we lost. And so, you know, we were interested in trying to see Libya stop this war if possible so we could go back and fully exploit our business.
I mean, why were you in Libya, not, say, in another part of the world where oil is being extracted? Why did you choose to go to Libya?
Because since we really own the world technology for rejuvenating oil wells, Libya had been producing as much as 3.8 million barrels of oil a day prior to the sanctions, and after 38 years of sanctions, their production was down to like 800,000 or 900,000 barrels a day. That has our name on it. Plus, their oil was plagued with paraffin and a lot of things like that, which we really deal with that better than anybody else can. So we looked at it as a new market, and our first trip in January 1st, 2007, shortly after the first treaty was signed between Congolese Arise and Gaddafi, we went there to look at the country to see if it was really something that we could think about. We knew the market could be ours, but we didn't know about Libya, you know. So we went in there with a bunch of security and went in there to find out if it was as bad as what all the news said. And it was exactly the opposite. And after 2 days, I sent our entire security group home. And Joanne and I were safer walking on the streets in Tripoli than we were in Houston.
So give us an idea of what your first impressions were when you arrived in Libya in 2008, 2009.
Well, after you arrived, there were three security checks after our plane landed to get all our baggage and everything checked to get into the country. And the people were very, very friendly. They loved Americans, you know. And the they were so receptive. They want to know how the West did business, you know, because they had literally been locked out of all contact for all practical purposes for 38 years, not because of the Libyan side. It was because they'd been sanctioned. And so, you know, we were really surprised. We'd walk on the streets and, are you American? Mia, Mia, they'd give us a thumbs up. Mia, Mia means like 100%. And they'd give us a thumbs up, you know, Hollywood, Americans, yay. And it was completely different. We did not expect that at all. We had done business all over the Middle East. We had partners in Kuwait and the royal family and all over, you know. And so it was really a surprise for us.
What about the sort of quality of life generally there, you know, and the I suppose, general happiness factor? The people are thinking, you know, you think of Africa as being a place which is quite poor, but I understand Libya, for example, had a very, very low rate of child mortality. You know, the people were very healthy.
Yeah, Libya had one of the lowest rates, of, I think, if not the lowest in the world, of infant mortality. The people there were very happy. They had... We were in many homes. We were in many government facilities. Beautiful homes, some of them. Some of them more not so extravagant. But all of the people there had food, had what they needed. Most of them had cars.
No Libyan had any debt. When you were married, the government gifted you $46,000. For each child, you got a $5,000 gift from the government. Your first automobile cost you half a dealer invoice. Premium grade gasoline cost 44 cents a gallon. Hospitalization was free, and if you couldn't get the treatment you needed in Libya, then the government paid for you and a family member to travel anywhere in the world, all expenses paid, plus all your hospital bills paid to get the treatment you needed. Education was free. If your brain would support it, they'd send you anywhere in the world and pay your expenses. We knew a young man that was getting his doctorate in England. He had a wife and four kids. Besides all of his school bills and university bills paid, his stipend was £4,500 a month. And, you know, your home cost you 10% of your salary for 20 years. There were 620,000 new condominiums being built in 2011. If your salary was $800 a month, paid $80 a month for 20 years, and then the title was yours. No utility costs.
But I mean, we've been told in the West that Colonel Gaddafi was a dictator and a tyrant.
Absolutely a lie. But, you know, if you're believing that, then you know where the lie came from. Now, he was absolutely the opposite of that. In fact, the Treaty of 2006 required that Gaddafi step down from power, which he did. And if you were a person in Libya and you made bad business decisions and you needed food, there were storehouses all over Libya. You could go up there. They didn't ask you for an ID or anything. They'd give you 50 kilos of rice, 50 kilos of flour. They'd give you milk and cheese, and they would give you enough money to buy an animal to be slaughtered for your family.
So you're saying that there was just free food available for anyone that wanted it?
Yes, absolutely.
And the highest salary in all of Africa at $15,800 a year, that was higher than China, higher than India. So anybody that says Libya wasn't developed, not true. The government had no debt. They spent 49% of their income running the government. The rest of it was participated out amongst the people.
So imagine you were hiring Libyans to work for you. How did you find that? Did that work out okay?
They were great people. Yeah, they had a really good work ethic. They were proud of their jobs. They really were interested in learning. And, you know, they were hardworking people. They were, you know, their work ethic, you know, 10 hours a day, 6 days a week was a good deal. If you wanted to work them 40 hours, that was okay too. But they were willing to work as long and hard as needed to get the job done.
The country was highly developed too. They had wireless there that we didn't have here in Texas. They had, in 2007, they had 4G wireless in Tripoli. They had, you know, the women were emancipated by Gaddafi in the 1970s. Women were, in 2011, we worked with the highest lawyer in Libya, Dr. Fatima Binyaron. Women were lawyers, doctors, entrepreneurs. They were in the military. They could do anything they wanted. We were free to move around and go anywhere we wanted, except out into the desert, you had to get a permit.
Okay, but I mean, that's what I was going to say. I mean, isn't Libya mostly desert with a few palm trees along the coast?
Yeah. most of the people, you know, it was a small population, 6.5 million people. Most all of them lived along the Mediterranean. But the Sahara is a huge, of course, desert. The strange thing was the largest freshwater aquifer in the world lays under the Sahara. And Gaddafi had built the Great Man-Made River, bringing that fresh water into areas that were not so arid anymore, where they were going to make it a breadbasket for North Africa. And that was a reality. That the Great Man-Made River was built. It, incidentally, was blown up completely by the U.S., UN, and NATO.
You also mentioned that Libya didn't have any debt with the International Monetary Fund. I mean, did you actually notice any difference because of that on the ground?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, our first trip in there, they didn't deal with credit cards or anything. We had some cash, but the Libyans asked us to stay over longer than the 4 days we'd planned. We had meetings with the Minister of Petroleum in Egypt the next week, and they asked us to please stay over because ministers wanted to meet with us to talk to us about the West. And so I had to get some more money, some more cash. The only way I could get any cash into Libya was via Western Union. They had no relationship with any international bank, no Zionist bank, period. So they were not befouled, if you would, by toilet paper money.
That made us very happy.
And then Gaddafi saw the evil of the Khazarian mafia banksters, and so he started the gold-backed currency for all of Africa. It was a reality. Its head offices were in the Comore Islands. And Libya was really blown up to stop that gold-backed currency because who would want toilet paper when they could have a real asset back?
Well, I mean, you're talking about the dollar as toilet paper, but this is people's bread and butter, I'm afraid, right around the world, isn't it?
Well, but it's toilet paper. There's nothing behind it. There's, you know, the guys that own the Federal Reserve own the European Central Bank. They own Bank of London. You know, they print money without any regard, any assets. And it's their money. You have the right to use it, but it's theirs. And so they print all the money they want, and they buy based on your belief that that's worth something. But it's being proven day by day by day that it's not worth anything.
So what was Gaddafi planning with this African currency then?
To develop Africa with African resources. And all the Arab countries had signed up as members of the African Bank. Half of Africa had signed up as members. And the Khazarian mafia banksters could not have that. That they had to blow that up. They had to stop the African bank. That was the primary reason Libya was blown up. All the stories you heard about Gaddafi being an ogre and all this stuff, that just absolutely was not true.
I mean, what about Lockerbie? Surely that is a case which is known to have been carried out by the Libyans, the blowing up of Pan Am 747 over Scotland.
That's been disproven.
That's not true. That, in fact, the CIA, in testimony at the Hague, they admitted that plane was blown up to prevent the file on the drug business that the CIA and other security services all over the world were involved in. And the head of that department, there were three investigators for the FBI and CIA that were on that plane. They had all the proof with them. They were flying back to Washington, D.C. That's why all the politicians were told not to get on that plane. That's why the plane was full of students. Remember, it was
Sorry. Who was told not to get who was told not to get on the plane?
All the politicians from all the dignitaries in the world that were due on that to fly on that plane were recommended not to fly on. That's what finally broke that apart. Libya had nothing to do with Lockerbie. They had nothing to do with the young officer that was killed outside the Libyan embassy.
Gaddafi
was all been proven.
Gaddafi hated radical Islam. He was not a terrorist. He never did any acts of terror. He hated it. They were not allowed in Libya. They were not. If you were a radical Islamist in Libya, you were either in jail or in exile. About 4% of Libyans are radicals.
Well, that's true, because I know MI6 had something called the Islamic Fighting Group, which was trying to kill Gaddafi, and they were sponsoring them to do that. We had two whistleblowers from MI5, David Shaler and Annie Machon, who resigned when they discovered that MI6 were actually paying terrorists to kill Gaddafi back in the 1990s.
Libyan Islamic Fighting Group headed by Bill Hodge.
Go back and look at who started the Muslim Brotherhood, who started Al-Qaeda. All these are inventions of the CIA, Mossad, MI6, and Shirate, all of them. It's proof positive that ISIS is 100% mercenaries for the United States. We fly money and weapons and supplies into them. When they get in a box, the United States takes ISIS out of wherever they are. They dumped a couple of hundred in Canada.
We know this for sure, Tony. We know it from our own experience because we were captured by Al-Qaeda while we were in Tripoli, taken to their torture center and sentenced to death. Those Al-Qaeda terrorist mercenaries were being supported by NATO. We saw it with our own eyes.
What did you actually see? Did you see NATO soldiers there?
We saw not only NATO.
Mossad was there. Blackwater was there. There were all kinds of people on the ground there fighting against Libya.
Can you tell me, what did Gaddafi believe in? Was he a capitalist? Was he a socialist? What was he?
Have you ever read the Green Book that he wrote? I would have to say it's more towards socialism. He believed that if the state had all this money, it needed to give the people a good life. They needed to share in what was being taken from the ground, and it's part theirs. And it's a real interesting philosophy he had, but he absolutely lived it and breathed it.
He was probably closer to a benevolent dictator if you could do that. But they had two legitimate houses of government. One of them was elected. The other one was came from the tribes. They each had their own function in the government. And it was a pure democracy from one standpoint, because if you had a complaint, you went to your tribe, and if you didn't get a resolution there, you went to the next club of tribes, etc. But it was, people there had a real redress of any kind of complaint. And the thing is, they didn't have any debt. They didn't have any, they had no problems with getting a job or keeping a job or growing their family or anything like that. It was a different kind of society, but probably closer to socialism in that the wealth of the country was really legitimately divided up amongst the people.
But people
not
are,
like socialism, where you have a few big fat cats at the top that soak it all up, and it's owned by them. It's not fascism. It's not.
But
really
people
socialism.
Were not taxed in Libya to give Libyan people money. They shared in the oil wealth. So I don't even think there was any tax. They had free utilities. There was no tax in Libya. We had met a young man in 2011 who'd been in England going to school. And he said, you know what? I found out what slavery is in England. I said, how's that? And he said, they gave me a credit card. He said, and I bought stuff. Now I have debt. That is slavery, he said.
He was the son of the ambassador from Libya to England. He said he had over 10,000 pounds in debt.
Yeah. And he said, I never had any debt. I didn't even know what it was. Because Libyans don't have credit cards.
Okay, most of Libya was desert. I imagine if you're in the oil business, you'd be out in the desert. And what was it like trying to live out there?
Well, we never lived out there.
There's a whole lot of Libya that's not desert. There's the Green Mountain area. There's Benghazi. And Tripoli's not desert. And south of Tripoli's not desert.
All along the Mediterranean. That was the biggest Roman development in the entire world. Was Liptis Magna there in Libya. It had a beautiful coastline. Go back, 10 or 15 miles from the Mediterranean, you've got a beautiful country all along the coastline.
You had a lot of oil, a lot of olive orchards and date orchards. And, the Italians occupied Libya for a long time and built these big mansions and orchards of olives and all kinds of stuff. And when they left, the Libyans took back their country, they're still running those olive orchards.
So did you have any exploration? Did you go into the desert at all much? Did you go through the desert?
We went into the desert a couple of times.
We went to Gaddam's, which is way deep in the desert, southwest on the Tunisian border, way, way deep. Gaddam's a 3,000-year-old city.
That was the head of the slave trade for the world at one time, and the entire town of 40,000 people was under one roof. Real unique place. There are other areas in Libya where the clay in the ground is just right, and they built all their houses underground to stay off the heat. They maintain 22 degrees 24/7, 365 by living actually in huge caves in the ground that they dug. It was a really unique place.
Here in the UK, I don't know about in the US, but we had a lot of negative publicity right the way through the 1980s, 1990s, the noughties about Libya. We had, I mentioned Lockerbie. We also had something called the death of PC Yvonne Fletcher outside the Libyan embassy in London. But a Dispatches documentary in the 1990s, early 90s, called Murder in St. James, explained that it was impossible for her to have been shot from the Libyan embassy because of the trajectory of the bullet, which had entered, you know, gone sort of vertically through her body rather than horizontally. And so it can't, she couldn't possibly have been shot from the Libyan embassy, which, you know, the program said that there was a particular place where the bullet could have come from, where someone could have been standing who shot her. And that was somewhere which was being used by the security services, that is to say the CIA and MI6 again. So it looks as if there was an attempt there to frame the Libyans, but actually with our own security services, with our own secret services, deliberately killing a woman police officer in London in order to try and make the Libyans look bad. So there was a lot of negative thoughts. I mean, it sounds to me like it would be a fascinating place if it wasn't for all the negative news stories to do with Libya, most of which seems to have been fabricated, as a tourist destination.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. You know, the thing that we found out is that nothing that we had been told about Libya was correct. And who wins from those agenda lies? Well, you know, when they threw out the despot king, that guy was installed by England to exploit the oil and gas reserves and resources of Libya.
That's right. His name was King Idris, and apparently his family is still in London. I suppose they may be rubbing their hands, hoping to take over Libya again sometime.
True. Well, you know, but the salary during his reign, if you would, was 60 dinar a year. You know, as soon as he was thrown out, he was a bloodless coup. He was a pedophile. He was absolutely garbage. So as soon as these 11 tribes get together and say, you've got a couple hours to get on the plane, get the hell out of Dodge, he did. So it was a bloodless coup, and immediately the country started to develop. And the thing that was wonderful about that is that when the oil companies were in there, they started building schools and hospitals and clinics and training the Libyan people about how to operate and work in the oil field. And it was a great boon to the Libyans. And then, of course, when the sludge pits, if you would, anytime you drill an oil well, you have a bunch of drilling material and stuff that comes out as you're drilling the well. And proper stewardship of that well would be to clean up that sludge pit. And none of the British or French or U.S. oil companies ever cleaned up anything. They just dumped this stuff out in these huge sludge pits in the desert, and you can see them from satellites. That there's so much in those wells that they have waves and stuff. You can see them from satellites. Gaddafi called them the scar on the desert. And so proper stewardship and not being properly paid for what was coming out of the ground, everything, eventually, as any country that has any sense, they will make the producers accountable for what they're taking out of the ground. And when there was so much corruption discovered, then Gaddafi said, either start treating us right or else we're going to take it over. And when they took it over and they tried to throw him over so many times, beginning the first week after. And he was a colonel. He was not a general or anything, but he was very charismatic, well-trained, well-educated. And so they tried to throw him over, and I'm talking about they, that being the CIA, Mossad, MI6, and sure, they tried to throw him over beginning the first week. And they said, the only way we're going to deal with you is if you reinstall the king as the leader. And he said, we're not going to do that. So that's when they started putting sanctions on Libya. And, of course, he then turned to the next best place to learn how to run a country, and that was Russia. And so he really got a black eye because Russia was bringing in technical people, and they were helping them develop the country and how to put in proper sewer systems and garbage disposal, water purification plants, et cetera. The Germans joined in helping developed that part of Libya. So they were making, they were developing Libya for the people.
Libya,
and of course,
you know,
that flew in the face of what the bad guys wanted.
At the time, the old king was there, and he was not a king of Libya. He might have been of the eastern part over by Benghazi, one third of Libya. But Libya really never had a king. They had some sheikhs. So this was not anybody Libya recognized, Libyan people recognized as really. There's a
I mean, you mentioned the tribes a few times, haven't you? I mean, I've always thought of people in that part of the world not necessarily as normal kind of settled people living in their condominiums or whatever. The idea that actually people can be a bit mobile, and that fits with the idea of the tribes. So who are the tribes?
Well, the Libyan tribes are
there are 809 tribes.
Yeah, but all Libyans are members of tribes. And they go back thousands of years, and they still have the general secretariat of the tribes. All the tribes talk to each other, do things together. It's still
But surely with 800 tribes, it's going to be impossible to get an agreement with so many.
That's the tough part. There are some big tribes.
The major tribes are about 11 big ones. The rest, some of them have 10 people, you know, I mean – those people don't play a major role. It's the big tribes, like the Warfala tribe is the biggest one, has 2 million people. And Bani Walid is where they come from. And Bani Walid is southeast of Tripoli. And it's a beautiful mountainous area. They're in a valley, a green valley, actually. So it's kind of interesting to learn about Libya. There's so much that's misunderstood about it. But what I wanted to say was in 1969, when they had their bloodless coup, the first time the Libyans actually ran their own country without some other country being there, like Italy was there the whole time, they had the average salary was 60 dinar a year for a Libyan. They were not allowed to even own any land in Libya. And after Gaddafi took over in 69, the first thing he did was give the land to the people, the land they'd been working for the Italians mostly. And from 1969 to 2011, he took that country to the top in 40 years, 42 years. So how many leaders have ever done that? I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Well, certainly our leaders in the West seem to have gone in the opposite direction, really, from the 1970s till today. You know, living standards have fallen and fallen and fallen. But anyway, look, I know you were actually over there, weren't you, in February 2011, when this so-called civil war broke out. I wonder, can you just paint us a picture as someone that was actually there at the time as to what actually happened? Because what we heard was on the Al Jazeera network that Gaddafi was bombing his own people with his own air force. What was really going on?
Well, beginning in December of 2010, the Libyans said, you know, there are a lot of strange people coming into the country. The borders around Libya to any Arab or any Muslim was open. You didn't have to have a visa or anything. And they said that there are some real hard people coming into our country, and they're not normal people. They, you know, they try to get jobs with the military, and, you know, they can fix military weaponry that none of our people here can repair. They can pick up anything, they can fix it, and they're flooding all over the country. And then on the day that the phony uprising started, you covered it a little bit, but there were 18 police stations that were firebombed by car bombs within an hour. They were all over the country. And they would steal a car, turn it into a firebomb, drive it into the police station. They destroyed all the records in those major police stations, took weapons out of it, and this was a coordinated event. This was not some bunch of guys that said, well, we need to take over the country. The three people that were supposedly killed in Benghazi were shot by snipers from, I think it was Qatar. And that was proven later on. Again, the trajectory of the bullets and where they were located. Those men were taken by the mercenaries, USUN and NATO mercenaries, and incidentally, USUN, NATO, and England brought in 250,000 mercenaries into Libya because the Libyan people were not a part of this war. This was an absolute takeover of the country. And
who was hiring these mercenaries, and what nationality were they?
They were from all over the world.
A mix.
There's a farm club team kind of organization that the intelligence agencies, these criminal intelligence agencies, Mossad, MI6, CIA, etc., they have these training centers in all parts of the world, Afghanistan, Sudan, all over, and they train these mercenaries. They equip them, they pay them. These guys were paid $2,500 a month. They were paid $1,000 for each person they killed in Libya. And the money flowed in. There was $500 billion of Libyan money in the Federal Reserve System and the European Central Bank and Bank of Japan. All that was confiscated the first week of this phony deal, and a central bank, a Zionist central bank, was set up with these mercenaries being declared the legitimate Libyans and owners of this money. They weren't even Libyans. They came from Afghanistan. They came from Yemen. They came from the Sudan.
Came
they
from came Egypt.
Egypt, from Jordan, from all over.
So when this war broke out, didn't some of Gaddafi's family try to flee the country for safety's sake?
Not true. Never happened. If there was anybody like Gaddafi, Dom, who's a distant relative, and looks a lot like Gaddafi.
He
had business in Egypt. He just went to Egypt.
But I mean, I seem to remember seeing that Gaddafi's personal residence was targeted, and one or two of his children killed or something?
Yes, they killed his youngest son. One of the first places we went on our fact-finding commission was to Saif al-Arab's house in Tripoli. They sent a bunker buster right in the middle of his house, killed three of Gaddafi's grandchildren who were there, and killed him.
They were laser-guided weapons directed at a civilian's home. But that's not all of it. They blew up schools and hospitals, water treatment plants, power plants, 20,000 palm trees. They blew up agricultural areas. 60,000 sorties, the U.S., UN, and NATO affected into Libya. More bombs were dropped in Libya than World War II combined, because the Libyan people were not a part of this war. It was a takeover of that country.
Tripoli did not fall. And so when the tribes developed a constitution, they were told they had to have a constitution for their country by the UN. This would stop. So the tribes came together and agreed 100%. This is the first time in I don't know how many years, 100 and some years, the tribes agreed on everything.
All tribes.
Yeah. And we were sitting with Sheikh Ali, the leader of all the tribes. When they delivered him, he said, "This is our new constitution. This will stop now." 3 days later, NATO came into Tripoli with their black helicopters and just started to mow people down on the streets. They killed 1,300 in an hour, put 5,000 in the hospital, and just started bombing and just brought in these little trucks with these guys with beards and the anti-aircraft guns on them, just brought them into the port and just loaded them off. We have pictures out of our hotel room window.
We saw two of these helicopters coming in low off the Mediterranean, mowing down every man, woman, and child in Tripoli. The third one we heard but didn't see it. We were on the 22nd floor of the hotel looking out over the Mediterranean, and we saw these planes come in.
You could hear the cannons. I mean, we heard
they
bombing
were
all the time,
down everybody that was on the street.
Now I'm talking to James and Joanne Moriarty. They were actually in Libya, in Tripoli, at the beginning of the whole phase of what's called the Libyan Civil War, which clearly was actually a regime change operation by NATO and Mossad and MI6 and the CIA, by Western intelligence services, deciding that Gaddafi was going to be removed from power. Their website is LibyanWarTheTruth.com, just one word, LibyanWarTheTruth.com. Now, Joanne, can you just give us an idea of when you realised that the whole civil war, even though it actually wasn't really a civil war, was going to go against Gaddafi?
Well, we knew that there was no hope for the Gaddafi regime. After we got been there a week or two with the fact-finding commission, we were actually there from May through to September. We were there 100 days. We got trapped in Tripoli. But they put out so many lies, it became a joke. We said, what does the CIA and the MI6 just wake up in the middle of the night and say, oh, well, let's say they're raping women, or let's say they're doing this. They could not break Tripoli. They could not break the people that were there. And they started to embargo Tripoli of food, of water, of medicine, of fuel.
So like a siege, we're talking about almost like medieval siege tactics.
Absolutely, 100%. That's exactly what you're describing. We couldn't believe it. The Libyans couldn't believe it.
To blow up a water treatment plant and restrict the electricity going into Tripoli when it was hot. That was summertime. It was older people had to have air conditioning and stuff.
They destroyed hospitals. They bombed hospitals. They bombed schools. But all the UN gave them was the right to a no-fly zone. They didn't give them the right to destroy the country by bombing it and putting all these troops in, all these mercenaries in that did things like rape women. They had rape houses. They had people would might come home. People that were against them might come home and find their babies chopped up in their refrigerator. You can't believe we taped a lot of this information. We have it.
These sorts of atrocities do sound almost impossible to believe, but we do know that this sort of thing does go on when someone is trying to take over another person's country. But look, James, you mentioned earlier that you were captured, and maybe we just sort of brushed over that. Can you just take us through that whole episode, please?
We were put on the kill list by a CIA operative. And in trying to get out of Tripoli, the Russian ambassador had put our names on a rescue ship that was being sent over by Malta to extract the dignitaries that were still left in Tripoli. And he called us and asked us if we'd like to be on that list. He said, your government's not going to help you. So he put us on the list, and our group grew from just Joanne and myself to seven people.
I mean, surely as U.S. nationals, the U.S. government is going to help you get out of the country if there's a civil war going on.
Not a chance we weren't supposed to get out.
In fact, we learned after we had the DIA, which is Defense Intelligence Agency, top echelon of the intelligence in the United States. The agent that was in our home was named Eric Maddox. That was his real name. He gave us a phony name, but his real name's Eric. He said, 1 week, he said, you know, y'all were never supposed to get out. He said, you should be written up in the Guinness records because nobody gets out of Al-Qaeda's hands alive. And then a couple weeks later, he came in, he said, you know, you and Joanne were never supposed to get out of North Africa alive. So, see, we were eyewitnesses to war crimes and atrocities. We were never to be able to tell our story. But in trying to get to the rescue ship, we were up and down the coast highway. We went 47 miles east and back to Tripoli, back and forth, trying to find the rescue ship. And we didn't know that it had been fired on by the U.S. UN mercenaries, and the ship was moored 3 miles off the coast. And so our second time back into the port of Tripoli, we were held inside the port for about an hour, and all of a sudden 20 or 30 or 40 of these little trucks rolled all around us. All the people jumped out, these mercenaries. We had 50, 60 AK-47s literally in our face. And the leader of that group said, your game is up. We know who you are. And they took us to their torture center. And we were in the torture center a long time. And in the end, the big, fat, bald imam wearing a dress came in there, and he said something in Arabic that I didn't understand. But what he had said is that they'd set up a kill zone 2 blocks away. And so we were to be videotaped about what good shape we were in, how we were well treated, and then we were going to be put in a van, supposedly to go to the rescue ship. We were going to get to this kill zone. We were to be killed and chopped up and burned.
And it was going to be blamed on Gaddafi.
We got out of there with three miracles to get back to the United States to be attacked by our own government. We have been soft killed and blacklisted since then. We've had all our bank accounts taken from us. We lost $200 million in Libya. We're not allowed to have a job. Anybody that tries to do business with us, they have their permits. They're alienated. We can't speak to our family or friends anymore. For all practical purposes, we're under house arrest. The only reason we're alive today is because Joanne is in contact with the Libyan tribes every day, and the intelligence agencies find out what the Libyans are doing via Joanne.
But also, we're alive because we went public. There's a lot of people that know about us now. That's the only choice we had when the CIA came in and said, you either shut up about what you know or you won't have a life.
They planted drugs in our car. They picked us up on the highway one time, wouldn't give us a badge, wouldn't give us a name. They kept us for 31 and a half hours. They said, we can make you disappear anytime we want. You need to shut up about what you saw in Libya. We've had three intelligence agencies threaten to kill us if we didn't shut up about what we saw. And, we are literally homeless. We used to have three homes. All that has disappeared. It's all been taken from us.
We were targeted when we came back in because when we went through passport control in Houston, Jimmy was taken into the FBI. See, where they missed this? They went through everything, all of our stuff. The Al-Qaeda went through all of our suitcases. They took everything, our passports and everything. But they didn't check me personally. I had a hard drive hidden on my person. And they didn't touch me. They don't like to touch women unless they're going to rape them or kill them, I guess. So they didn't touch me. They touched the men. But when we got to the United States, the FBI took Jimmy, but they just let me go on through down to the luggage. They went through his suitcase. They took the lining out of his suitcase. They did. They wanted to know how he got there, who paid for it, everything, I guess. I wasn't there for that interrogation, but when the CIA lady was in our house, she said they targeted you at the Houston airport. It's when you were targeted.
Well, Joanne, they're not going to forget to do that again. I mean, what did you have on that hard drive?
I have 200 gigabytes. I have proof of war crimes. I have interviews we did with families that invited us in to their home. They didn't want to talk to the CNN or any foreign media was there because they saw them putting out lies. We were on TV a whole bunch while we were in Libya because we were the only Americans there that weren't media or working with NATO.
We're listening to Joanne and James Moriarty. Their website is LibyanWarTheTruth.com. That's LibyanWarTheTruth.com. I'm going to ask you now about what's happening now, because over the last month or so, we've been getting news, maybe even 6 weeks, even 2 months or so, about this chap, Khalifa Haftar, who apparently is trying to overthrow the government of Libya at the moment, even though I understood that there are actually two governments in Libya right now. Can you just pull apart what's actually really going on for us, please?
Sure. It's not Khalifa Haftar is a CIA operative, and the Libyans know it, but he was the only one allowed to gain weapons for the Libyan National Army. He himself is really just a figurehead. The Libyan National Army, supported by the Libyan people and the tribes, is what is in Tripoli. And they're not trying to overthrow any government. They're trying to throw out the illegitimate militia terrorists that have been controlling Tripoli since 2011.
Okay, can you explain this whole business of having two different governments? I understood one of the governments was actually operating on a ship in the Mediterranean and the other one on the land.
No, that's not true. In 2014, Libya had an election, supposedly backed by the UN. What happened in that election is they threw out all the Muslim Brotherhood out of their government and all the terrorist militias that were working with the Muslim Brotherhood. And militias are like gangs in the street. They're armed and they control people. So what happened was they attacked the people that were elected, and those people had to move themselves to Tobruk, to the east of Libya. They have their government in Tobruk and Albaida City now. That's the actually legitimately elected House of Representatives and Parliament for Libya, but they have no power.
They had to move because they were attacked in Tripoli. They were killed, their wives raped, etc. So they had to get out of Tripoli in order to form the government in another part of the country.
And so the UN didn't like what was going on. They lost their power in Libya. So what they did was, in 2015, they formed a new government in Tunisia. Not elected government, not anybody the Libyans wanted, didn't talk to anybody in Libya. Just appointed this Sarraj guy and most of his family, who are also Muslim Brotherhood, LIFG, Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and other people. Libyans said, we don't want them. We don't want a UN government in Tripoli. We don't want anything in Tripoli. Well, they didn't listen. Of course, they snuck that government in by boat, by night, into Tripoli. And Belhaj, who's the head of LIFG, protected them, brought them into an area that was safe for them. And once they put their feet on the ground in Tripoli, the UN said, oh, this is the legitimate government in Libya now. We recognize this government. That government has done nothing for the Libyan people. Nothing has been repaired. They have let the French steal Libyan gold. They let the Italians steal Libyan gas. They let the Israelis steal Libyan oil. They steal Libyan money every day and pay these mercenaries who are armed by Turkey and Qatar and other places. So the Libyan people are just suffering. They have nothing.
Food is up four or five times what it was in 2011. There's no water.
The hospitals are bad. There's not very little medicine in the country. People can't afford. Hospitals are extremely expensive. There's no free medicine. There's nothing. So the people are suffering, and they know they have to cleanse these militias and this UN puppet government out of their country if they're ever going to have any sovereignty. So finally, they got their Libyan National Army together, technically under Haftar, who is, like I said, just a figurehead, and they're in Tripoli working to cleanse that now. The media is saying, oh, this is a civil war in Libya. Well, I don't guess it's a civil war because the Libyan people aren't fighting each other. They're fighting these mercenaries who are in their country and have been occupying it illegally since 2011.
Sounds like echoes of Syria as well here, that, you know, these things that are called civil wars aren't really civil wars at all when one faction is mostly imported mercenaries from abroad.
Exactly.
Also, I mean, another interesting thing about all this is that there may be, of course, still some members of Colonel Gaddafi's family is still around who may take a role in the future government.
Yes, there is one especially, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi. He is the second son of Gaddafi, and he was actually going to be the heir apparent at some point. He's highly educated. He has a PhD. He has a degree in engineering and also in economics, I think. And he's also, interestingly enough, he's a peace guy. He is against war. He doesn't want to attack anybody. But he is being charged by the ICC for war crimes. He didn't do anything. Not one thing. He doesn't even know how to pick up a gun. His two brothers who were fighting were killed. So, you know, they
can't the International Criminal Court, this is the same International Criminal Court that still hasn't prosecuted Tony Blair or George Bush for the illegal invasion of Iraq, but still seems to go around Africa finding ethnic minority leaders to criminalize. So I don't think they've got a lot of credibility, really, the International Criminal Court.
No. And Libya doesn't recognize them anyway. The Libyan people are 90% behind Saif if they ever have a national election.
So can we get back to Khalifa Haftar? I'm a bit confused because he's running something called the Libyan National Army, which is actually acting in the national interest against the colonial, you know, outside interests. And yet you said he's working for the CIA.
He is a CIA operative. He's tried to tell the Libyans I don't work for him anymore, but he does because the Libyan National Army was embargoed by the UN against getting weapons in 2011, and it has continued that embargo to this day. Even President Trump came out and said they need to remove the embargo against the Libyan National
Army.
So,
I mean, it almost sounds as if Khalifa Haftar is gone native, although he's still got relations with the Western intelligence services, that maybe he's a double agent.
Well, and he's got a lot of people around him that are not trustworthy, but he has agreed with the tribes. He has promised, in order for the tribes to stand with him, because he had nothing without the tribes, with them bringing their armies in, he has a big army now, and he's got Egypt with him, and he's got Russia with him. But he promised he would allow a countrywide election, that he was not going to take over and be a dictator. The Libyans don't want him to be a dictator. Actually, in the 1970s, when he joined the CIA and left Libya during the Chad Wars, he was found a traitor in Libya by law in absentia and sentenced to death. Of course, they blew up all the courthouses, so there's none of those records around anymore.
But he and 30 of his cohort military people from Libya in Chad were picked up by the CIA. They were taken to Langley, Virginia. They lived there 30 years. They all hold U.S. passports. So they are absolutely 100% CIA operative.
Believe me, the Libyans do not trust him. They know the dirty game that's been played against him and is continuing to be played. But they have a saying. They say one by one. And they said, we have to cleanse these mercenaries. We have to get them out of our country before we can do anything else. This is our first step. And if we have to do it with Haftar, so be it.
So, I mean, is Saif Gaddafi, do you think there's any possibility that another Gaddafi may one day rule Libya?
Oh, yeah, or maybe another one. There's a real strong leader from the Tuaregs, from the desert people, real bright, great leader that is coming forward. You know, there will be a Libyan leader.
Gaddafi's daughter is very bright. Yeah. She would be a great leader, but I don't know if they would let her be a leader in their culture. I don't know. But they love Saif. It's a very big possibility that he will be the next leader there if the imperialists let him. You know, I mean, I don't know.
He'll be successful if he brings around him people that have capacity to really put the government back together. There's been $1 trillion worth of damage done to Libya.
Now, I mean, you two run this LibyanWarTheTruth.com website, which is a great resource, but can you give us an idea of any other decent places that we can go? Because obviously CNN, the BBC, ITV, Channel 4 News are not going to be really telling us what's going on. In fact, even the BBC World Service, when the recent offensive by Khalifa Haftar broke out, they had some guy come on who was saying, well, actually, he's not a warlord, because they were trying to characterise him as a warlord. And then when it went on to the Listen again, that bit got edited out. So the BBC are also putting out a lot of propaganda and editing the truth from their broadcasts. So where are good places to find out what's going on, either on, you know, sort of satellite channels or else maybe on online?
Well, we have a Patreon channel, too, that we put out news there.
Videos that we're blocked from putting out every place else. We have been releasing them via Patreon every Monday night. That's patreon.com/ James and Joanne Moriarty.
And we live, you know, by the sale of our little DVD that you can buy on our website. But
we
also
released on Benghazi, we released the names and all the details of who actually killed Chris Stevens. How it happened.
Okay. This is another episode we didn't really mention, which we should have done, I suppose, is what happened in Benghazi. What's the short version?
He was killed because.
So this is the U.S. ambassador was killed, wasn't he?
Yes, sir.
He was assassinated.
He was assassinated. And he was killed because the dinner he had that night with the Turkish ambassador, he was tasked to get back these rockets that Hillary Clinton bought in 2009, 50,000 shouldered air rockets, most sophisticated ones U.S. builds, 20,000 of them delivered into Libya, and the countries all over the world demanded that the U.S. get these back out of the hands of the radicals, because that's enough rockets to shoot down all the military aircraft and a bunch of the civilian too. So Chris Stevens was to get them back, have Erdogan use his influence to recover those, U.S. pay whatever price, and he was told, Chris Stevens was told to pound sand when the ambassador left. He went out of the front of that building, taken by a fast part of the airport. When his plane landed in Turkey is when they started the attack on that building in Benghazi. But we have video.
So who attacked the American ambassador then?
The LIFG with a coordination of a U.S. person. And the idea was to assassinate Chris Stevens. His itinerary had been put out by Hillary Clinton to everybody.
Okay, so what was the motive to kill him?
Because he, dead men tell no tales. He was the gun runner for Hillary Clinton for the 2011 attack on Libya and running it into Syria along with mercenaries. He was the guy.
Now, let's go back to the question I asked you previously, which is about good news sources, satellite channels, and websites, please.
Okay. VoltaireNet.org. VoltaireNet.org is a great one for all the Middle East and North Africa. That's Terry Mason's site, and he was there actually in Libya when we were there. He's real well known.
He was the first person to do a really good critical reporting about the 9/11 attacks. A very fascinating guy. So that's Thierry Mason, and his website is VoltaireNet. Any more?
I would say
SOTT Radio.
SOTT.
Yes, that's SOTT, stands for Signs of the Times. SOTT.net.
Yes, yeah. That's two Irish guys. They live in France. We've been on there. Radio show a bunch, but they write a lot of articles. Zero Hedge does actually put out some real stuff.
Scott Bennett's a great guy. He trails the flow of money to the terrorists. He's got documented all that. He was put in jail. He was an intelligence officer in the U.S. And when he tried to file his report showing the flow of money to all the terrorists and everything, they put him in jail. Scott Bennett, and his site is...
Are there any other satellite rolling news channels that are worth watching?
RT, I think I would watch. That's the only one I'd watch. RT or even Press TV sometimes. I wanted to tell you Harland Report out of the, I think she's what, in the Netherlands? She's in Norway, I think.
You're going to have to spell that for us.
Okay. H-E-R-L-A-N-D, I think. Harland Report.
Hannah Harland.
Yeah.
She's got about a 13 million.
She comes to the United States from time to time. Yeah, the Herland Report. Herland Report.
Final question is, what do you think the future is for Libya?
Well, I think the Libyans are going to take their country back, because it's either that, if you were to talk to a Libyan tribal person today, a leader like I talked to, they'd say either we win this or our country's gone, and they will die trying to take their country back, period. So they're going to, and this is a big deal for the Zionists too, because they're watching. This was a Zionist victim country. You know, they've taken it over, control it. A lot of countries they've done this to, and countries are all watching Libya. Libya takes their country back. That's not good for them if a country takes their sovereignty back, especially Libya, because it was so destroyed. It was so destabilized.
Okay, Joanne and James Moriarty, thanks very much for joining us.
God bless you.
Thank
Keep
you, Tony.
In your prayers.
Thank you for having us on.
The website is libyanwarthetruth.com. Thanks very much. Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Joanne and James Moriarty. The website is libyanwarthetruth.com. Also to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk, and you can even phone them on Bristol 909 6897. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. So, thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, until next Tuesday, midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Possibility of tomorrow's world.
He sits alone, waiting for suggestions. He's so nervous, he's avoiding all the questions. His lips are dry, her heart is gently pounding. Don't you just know exactly what they're thinking?
You think I'm sexy?
Come on, sugar.
Don't touch me,
come on, honey. He's acting shy, looking for an answer. Come on, honey, let's spend the night together. Now hold on a minute before we go much further. Give me a dime so I can phone my mother. They catch a cab to his high-rise apartment. Last, he can tell her exactly what his heart meant.
You think I'm sexy?
Come on, sugar, let me know.
You think you can touch me?
Come on, honey, tell
me. They wake at dawn as all the birds are singing. Total strangers, but that ain't what they're thinking. Outside it's cold, it's misty and it's raining. They got each other, neither one's complaining. Ha ha, he says I'm sorry, but I'm out of milk and coffee. Never mind, sugar, we can watch the early movie.
No.
From 1979, those are the Hybrid Kids on Cherry Red Records. Do you think I'm sexy? And that's